For the week of November 25th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 430, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz. Happy post-Thanksgiving.
I don't know if that's actually a holiday. I've got a...
My niece has the day off from school, so it is for her.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you know, it's Cyber Monday, it's Black Friday, it's... what are they going to say, you know, for Tuesday? What are they going to, you know, what excuse are they going to have to go and shop on Tuesday?
Buy Michael a microphone Tuesday? I need a new blue dot or whatever these microphones are called for this podcast. It just seems to be breaking down.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com to, you know, find out where you should send your checks, your money orders, your carrier pigeons.
Someday you'll set up that donation button.
Oh my God, that's right. I set it up and then I never actually linked to it on the page. I have to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I spent Thanksgiving in Nashville, had a good time with friends. I saw the new Fantastic Beasts movie. What did you do for Thanksgiving? A lot. Apparently everybody went to the movies.
Yeah, everybody went to the movies. I did not go see Fantastic Beasts because I was told that if I did, I would spend the rest of my Thanksgiving holiday trying to figure out the plot. So I decided not to.
It wasn't complicated.
Okay, well, since I didn't see it and just, you know, read all the reviews, that's kind of what I got out of the reviews. Many plot lines, not all of them kind of come to fruition.
But you saw A Star Is Born, didn't you?
I did see A Star Is Born, yes.
There you go. Propping up that Oscar hopeful. Do you think it's an Oscar contender?
Maybe for the acting. I think people will want to see Lady Gaga at the Oscars and see what she wears. I think Bradley Cooper will get one, maybe not for directing, maybe for directing, who knows, but, you know, because he wrote, he directed, he starred in it, but he'll probably get a Best Actor nomination. Don't necessarily know whether he will win because everybody's now all hyped up on Vice. Why can't I remember? Christian Bale.
Christian Bale.
Yeah, Christian Bale for Vice. But apparently to win an Oscar,
everybody's not hyped up on anything because no awards nominations have been announced yet. No critics lists have come out. True. It's all just puffery from the publicists.
Correct. Yeah. But, you know, it was an inadequate movie. And I saw it, by the way, using MoviePass.
Oh, well, that's won't be true for much longer, but we'll have more news on that in the show. What else will we be talking about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're eating some leftovers and catching up on the news and entertainment. We've got a lot, but make sure you save some room for a piece of pie. And that's, you know, Thanksgiving jokes. And the Thanksgiving box office is not a joke because it set records. The art house movie The Favorite was a favorite in limited release. Studios might be pushing for shortened windows again. And white people in Hollywood can't seem to remember one simple rule. Don't say the N-word. Okay, it's really not that hard, people. Just don't say it. In China news, the most prestigious movie awards in Asia are mired in controversy. This didn't get a lot of attention in the Western press, but the Taiwanese Golden Horse honors might be in trouble. China was not pleased when the ceremony included calls by some for recognition of Taiwan's independence. In MoviePass news, we may not have MoviePass ticket around much longer, but Cinemia is ready to become a movie lover's new best friend. Michael's got a charming story of some serious sisterly devotion with his book filter pick of the week, one which, after reading about it, I want to read. On Inside Baseball, we focus in on music, where album sales are in serious decline. However, Taylor Swift's fortunes continue to rise. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We've got 2 weeks to cover here, and we're looking at a link from ComScore in our show notes. And we also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, all the big trades, all the big newspapers, and you, our listeners. And the number one movie around the world this weekend is Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. $113 million on the Friday to Sunday worldwide. It's at $440 million and counting. This one is having its bacon saved by overseas. It's done pretty poorly in the U.S., got mixed to poor reviews. It's not doing as well as the first one, but that's not true in most other territories. And it looks like this one will be okay. I actually saw it and I was kind of surprised. I thought it was better than the first and not that bad. It's not a good movie, but it's a little better than the first. I actually cared about what happened.
Oh, really? Okay. Because, you know, one of the things that I can remember about the first film, Fantastic Beasts film, is I can't remember a thing about it other than the little like platypus things.
Right, and I didn't care about anything in that movie. This one, Johnny Depp gives a relatively restrained performance as a fascist. They double down on the sort of our hero, Newt Scamander, being on the spectrum, both because we see him as a kid and adult. You've got Ewan McGregor, who plays Dumbledore?
Ewan McGregor.
Oh, it is Ewan McGregor, yeah. And it's just a solid cast. It's a lot of noise. The special effects are okay. Chase scenes are not that exciting, but the actual drama with a lot of good actors isn't that bad. I don't recommend it, but it's better than the first, I have to say.
You know, here's the thing about these movies. My kids are huge Harry Potter fans. They love Harry Potter. However, this weekend, what did they want to see?
Ralph Breaks the Internet.
That's correct. And that is the top movie in North America this weekend.
That's right. That's a huge movie in North America. It's the number two movie around the world. Friday to Sunday, it made about $100 million. So far, opening up on Wednesday, it now has $125 million. Great reviews. The first one had very good reviews too. These are even better. Great word of mouth. Great opening weekend. This one is going to be a big, big hit. So everybody's happy about that one. At number three around the world is Bohemian Rhapsody. Queen is outselling Lady Gaga. Another $50 million on the weekend. $475 million worldwide. This baby is going to blow past $500 million, and it's still going strong. It's profitable from North America alone, where it has tripled its budget.
Now, I wonder, is Bryan Singer, I know he got credit, but is he still like saying, I don't want anything to do with the movie. I didn't finish it. It's not my movie. Or is he saying, no, actually, I did it. It's my movie.
Well, I don't think it comes up. I mean, the movie's out. There's no press to do. He didn't do much press, I don't think.
No, he didn't.
Right. So, you know, if it gets Oscar hopefuls, it's probably Rami Malek more than anything else. People, the reviews weren't that good. You never know. Might get some Golden Globe stuff. Maybe it'll get a director nomination. I would assume not, but that would be an interesting dilemma. We'll see what happens. I'm sure he'd be happy to take any accolades and awards since he directed 98% of it.
Yeah, that's true.
At number four is Dr. Seuss's The Grinch, another hit, $37 million worldwide. It's tripled its budget pretty much at $215 million, and it's got a long way to go. And, of course, the holiday season. It's got another month where it can feel timely because it is a holiday Christmas-themed movie.
And then, of course, it will be played again and again and again and again every year ad infinitum.
Or unless you're sane and just simply watch the original animated special and you're done in 22 minutes.
You're a mean one, Michael Giltz.
At number five is Creed 2, a sequel to the Rocky series. This one about Creed, starring Michael B. Jordan. The original made $175 million worldwide. This one's going to do that better. $35 million on the weekend. $55 million since it opened up on Wednesday. Not very good reviews. They were polite and friendly. Most everyone said it was okay, but not as good as the first. But audiences loved it, doing much stronger out of the gate. We'll have to see how it does worldwide, but I think this one is going to build on the first. At number six is A Cool Fish. This is a Chinese black comedy about two-bit bank robbers, and I think from the trailer they're getting stalked by a really diligent guard. He's determined to catch them. It's broad. It's funny. Sort of Tarantino-esque. That's probably not the right word, but something like that is what I gather. But it made $25 million on the weekend. It opened a week ago, so it's at $50 million and counting. I'm thinking it opened up a week ago, so I think it kind of held really steady. It's in five territories. It's doing really well, making a lot of money. Number seven is a really big hit, Venom. $22 million on the weekend, $822 million worldwide. That's just a lot of money, period. And you know I don't like to play games about live action versus animated or a sequel with women in the lead. You know, nonetheless, somebody pointed out that Venom is one of the biggest origin story movies of all time. A movie kicking off a franchise for a superhero. This baby is it. It's bigger than almost every other launch in history. All the Marvels. Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, The Incredible Hulk, Deadpool it's beating, Guardians of the Galaxy, on and on and on, Batman. Spider-Man. You got to go back to the original Spider-Man to find a movie that matches it in box office. Of course, that's without adjusting for inflation. But Venom may even pass Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire and the reboot that just happened with Spider-Man Homecoming. In fact, you have to go back to the original Superman in 1978 and adjust for inflation. That movie starring Christopher Reeve made $300 million worldwide. That is $1.1 billion adjusted for inflation. And that means that original Superman is the second biggest of all time. That means the number one launch of a superhero of all time, Black Panther.
Oh, okay.
That's how big that puppy was.
Yeah,
even adjusting for inflation, Black Panther just happened earlier this year is the biggest launch of a superhero in film history. Venom damn near is number two. It's going to be number three probably when all is said and done, but it's certainly top five. That's how big this movie has become worldwide. $200 million in North America, $600 million and counting overseas.
And I could have sworn that you were going to say Flash Gordon when you said the number
exactly. Flash, oh. Do they have that song in the movie? Probably not, but they should. It's fun.
Which movie?
In the Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, I don't know, because it was a Queen song. That's true.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So it's the best part of the movie.
Yeah.
And number eight is a flop. We've got 25 films on our chart. About two of them are serious flops, Robin Hood and The Nutcracker in the Four Realms. Robin Hood opened up. It's in 34 territories. It cost $100 million to make. It's made $22 million so far worldwide and counting. A very, very poor showing for this movie. Terrible reviews, terrible audience reaction. However, it has a really cool poster. Kudos to the marketing people. I didn't see this till I was in the theater, but one of their posters shows Robin Hood. It's dark and moody, and he's in the middle of a forest. He's sort of a small figure surrounded by tall trees, and it's very dark and mysterious. But then you realize they're not trees. They're actually shafts of arrows. So the forest is actually shafts of arrows, and Robin Hood's at, and you're like, oh, that's very cool. It's a really great graphic element. Sort of hints and makes you think, wow, that movie's going to be great. Too bad the movie didn't deliver.
Well, isn't that what the poster is supposed to do? You're supposed to look at it and go, no. Wow, I want to see that.
Absolutely. You know, Star Wars The Phantom Menace had one of the great one sheets of all time. So, you know, they did their job. The movie just didn't deliver. At number nine is Widows, the Steve McQueen film starring Viola Davis. $12 million on the weekend, $38 million in counting. We'll have to see if this translates overseas, because that's what they're going to need, I think, to become a box office winner.
And at Show East, people came out of the screening of this and they just loved it.
Yeah, well, maybe the word of mouth will be strong enough. So far, it's a little dicey. It's in 44 territories. I'm thinking it's going to be a sort of a wash, but it's probably a little bit short of tripling its budget. We'll see. At number 10 is another film that's a question mark. It's Instant Family, a light comedy starring Mark Wahlberg. He's sort of become the Ice Cube of family-friendly movies of the last few years. He just keeps making them, and a lot of them are profitable. This one made $12 million on the weekend. It's at $35 million in counting. However, it costs $50 million to make. It seems a little high for this type of movie, but it's only in one territory, so we'll have to hold off and wait to see where it ends up. At number 11, that's certainly the case for Johnny English Strikes Again, the Rowan Atkinson spoof of James Bond. We were a little wary of this one at first, but it's really raked in the dough, and now it's opened up in China with a big $11 million. So this weekend, it made $12 million, most of that thanks to the Middle Kingdom, and it's at $142 million worldwide. So that is a full-on success story.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much money, $142 million on a $35 million budget.
Exactly. At number 12, I don't know the budget of this movie. It's a Spanish live-action film called Super Lopez. It's based on a comic book spoof of Superman. The comic book's been around, I think, since the 70s or the 80s, but a live-action version has come out, and it opened to $10 million. We don't know the budget. I assume it's not that big, but who knows? At number 13 is The Nutcracker in the Four Realms, Falling Hard, $130 million worldwide. And number 14 is A Star is Born with Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga, another $6 million in the weekend. That passed the $350 million mark worldwide. And number 15 is Unstoppable. It's a Korean action film written and directed by Min-ho Kim. It's about a gangster who's gone straight. He's done. He's out of the business. But then rival gangsters kidnap his wife, and he's out for revenge. $6 million on its opening weekend.
So this is like almost every revenge movie ever.
Exactly. At number 16 is Driving Miss Mahershala. I'm sorry, Green Book. $5 million on the weekend, $7.8 million total. It's in North America alone, a pretty weak wide release over the Thanksgiving holiday. Unless it gets great word of mouth among old people, this puppy's not going to pull it out. It costs $25 million to make. Viggo Mortensen had a few stumbles in the promotion of the movie, but we'll get to that later.
Don't say the N-word.
At number 17 is another problem film, The Girl in the Spider's Web, Claire Foy's attempt at a franchise. That's made $32 million so far. It's in a lot of countries, 52 countries. This baby's not going to work there. We are probably done with, you know, this, the girl tattoo lady, whatever you want to call her. That's not going to happen anytime soon.
Didn't she have a name? She,
It's Luis. I never read them.
Salander or something like
that. Yeah, Salamander. It's making me think of Newt Scamander. Now I'm getting
exactly
confused. And number 18 is J.J. Abrams' produced flick Overlord with Nazis and mutants or something. $38 million and counting. That's in 50 territories. That too will probably not pull it out, though. It's going to be okay thanks to probably a strong afterlife on video and streaming. And number 19 is that Korean remake of Intimate Strangers, the cell phone comedy. You know, everybody has dinner. They put their cell phones in the middle of the table and hilarity ensues. When I describe this movie to people, as I did over the Thanksgiving holidays, they're like, that's ridiculous. Nobody would do that. Nobody would do that. And yet they've made a movie.
I tried to, edge that theory along, or, you know, that concept along at my own Thanksgiving dinner, and I had no takers.
At number 20 is Asumer 3. This is a Peruvian comedy based on a hit TV show written and starring Carlos Alcantara, and it opened at $2 million. I could find very little information about the movie, which is weird because Asumar 1 and 2 are all over the place, and yet number 3 I didn't find on IMDb. I didn't find it on Wikipedia, but ComScore has it as opening up in one territory, which I assume is Peru, but somehow the information about the movie is not out there. I couldn't find a trailer. I just don't know what's going on with this thing, but it's there, and it's the third in a series, and it, you know, the first two did well, so this one, based on the budget, I guess it'll probably be okay too. And number 21 is another film that's a bit of a puzzle, Chinese Peacekeeping Forces. It opened to $1.5 million, but I have no idea what it is. It's in one territory. I'm going to go on a limb and guess that territory is China. I'm going to guess again that it's a documentary about Chinese forces keeping the peace.
Yes, I would concur.
Thank you. And finally, one more new movie I'd like to mention. It's Muslim. This is a biopic of the Turkish singer, also known as Papa Muslim. And it opened to it made $1.3 million this weekend. It's made $13 million so far in six territories. It cost $4 million to make. So this is a hit, a big, big hit in Turkey and presumably some other territories where this singer who specialized in folk tunes was a big, big star. What a crazy life. He was born dirt poor. He won a singing contest when he was a little kid. He started singing. Then he had a horrible car accident. It was so horrible, he was taken to the morgue. They thought he was dead before they realized he was alive. His brother was murdered. His father killed his mother. And in 1980, he shared the stage with a popular female singer, Muhterem Mur, a big star in her own right. She was 21 years older than him. And they started bickering on stage in front of the audience. And then they got married.
Well, six years later.
Yeah, 6 years later, but it was the beginning of a romance that led to marriage, and she's his widow. She buried him. So they had a marvelous, you know, marriage for 30 plus years.
You say that after all the murder and death, you're like, she buried him. alive, in fact.
Yeah, alive. No. They had a happy, fulfilling marriage. One weird detail is that he sang Turkish folk songs, and his audience members were so ecstatic that they took to cutting themselves with razor blades during the show.
Okay, none of this, I have to say, this sounds like a made-up story. This whole thing sounds like a made-up story.
It sounds like an emo story waiting to be made, except it's Turkish.
Oh, okay.
But there you go. So that was the box office chart. It was a big Thanksgiving, wasn't it?
It was. It was a record Thanksgiving. I always, you know, and I didn't have time to do it. I always want to go back and say, okay, let's look at ticket prices. When was the last record Thanksgiving? And it's not about adjusted for inflation at this point. It's about, you know, what were ticket prices when that last record Thanksgiving was recorded.
Well, we wish we had ticket sales to compare. That would be the best comparison between eras, even putting aside, you know, ticket prices. But we just don't have them in North America. But we do know that the box office is really big. Hollywood Reporter now says that at this rate, 2018 is almost certain to set a new all-time record. You know, with two big hit new films joining the charts with Ralph Breaks the Internet and Creed 2, North American box office is doing great. That's true even in limited release, isn't it?
That is true. In limited release, The Favorite, which is a movie I really want to see and probably can because I can go to the Landmark and use my movie pass, well, that scored a $105,000 per screen average over this past weekend, and it's not really on that many screens. It had the highest per screen average in the last 2 years, ever since La La Land opened up.
Right. Well, it's on four screens, I believe.
Okay.
Just a few screens in New York and LA, which is the same is true for Roma, which I think is also playing at the Landmark, isn't it?
Yeah, and I love the way Roma actually was on our box office. Oh, wait, actually, it wasn't on our box office charts, was it? Why?
No.
Because, of course, Netflix tells you nothing. They don't tell you anything.
Nope, nothing. And, you know, it opened a big business. They estimate it might have made $30,000 to $40,000 per screen because all the screenings were basically very full or sold out. They think it might have set a foreign language record for per screen average, but we'll never know. And so that raises the question, is this enough? We know that Oscar voters are probably heavily among the people who are going to these screenings, right? It's in New York and LA. There's probably a lot of Oscar voters in the audience. Is that going to be enough to make them say, okay, Netflix did their part? Do they feel like this is a box office release, or the fact that it's sort of invisible means it's less meaningful?
I think it, you know, this movie, Roma, if there is a movie that can help Netflix in its Oscar campaign, you know, trying to campaign for an Oscar, this would be it. I mean, it is.
Well, you got a great movie, then that's going to help, of course.
You've got a filmmaker that apparently can't seem to make a bad movie. Okay.
Well, no, no.
I know, but arguably people like his movies.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, he shot it really well. It's in, you know, 65 millimeter, black and white. It's a touching story. All the reviews are glowing. It might be too hyped. And they finally said, okay, we're releasing it in theaters before it hits Netflix in like 2 weeks. And yet, you know, I agree with you. I wonder if just 2 weeks and four theaters is enough, because I tried to go see this movie. And the reason that I saw A Star is Born is because Roma was sold out.
Why didn't you? Oh, you couldn't get it enough in advance because you had MoviePass.
Correct.
Well, you know, I believe it's a 3 week window before they open it up on Netflix. And I don't think they're necessarily yanking it from theaters after that 3 week window. So if it's still making money, maybe they'll just leave it in theaters. I mean, that would be smart to let people see it on a big screen if they want to. And I'm sure they're having, you know, Academy screenings as well. But we'll have to see how they deal with it. Will they just leave it in theaters if people are going there? Why not? They're happy to do day and date sometimes. So I would think they just leave it out there. If people are still going to the theater and filling it up, yeah, they're making money.
Well, yeah. And what I think that one of the downsides to not saying how much your box office is, of course, is that you don't get that marketing. Very often box office can be used to help market a film. That's why you always see number one comedy or number one movie in America. Because
right, there's a news story about The Favorite having one of the biggest per screen averages in years. If it set a record for a foreign language film, that would be great news.
Right, exactly. And you're also kind of missing the, well, I mean, you're missing the fact that, at least for Netflix, and maybe they don't care about this, that there is money in theatrical releasing. You know, releasing
well, yes,
a movie theatrically,
there's
money.
Yes, of course there is, but ABC and CBS don't worry about that, do they?
No, they don't.
Right. Well, Legendary isn't always caught up in money either. They have said, no, we don't want any money from Saudi Arabia. It's an indie U.S. studio. They want to sell off about $500 million of the company, but their Chinese owner has said Saudi Arabia is not an option. That possibility was floated up there, but apparently right now that money is too tainted and people don't want to go anywhere near it. They want to work with artists in Hollywood. They don't want any political controversy. We'll have to see when that slows down. But right now, Saudi money is too toxic to touch.
Yeah, and it's considered a U.S. independent studio, but it's really a U.S. independent financier that is owned by a Chinese owner. So,
well, you think the Chinese owner might care less and yet they recognize that for the American market and the people you want to work with, directors and actors and whatever, that this is a touchy issue right now. They're hoping they can hunker down and it will pass. But for right now, Saudi money is toxic.
Yeah, well, I guess the reason I mention all of that is it's pretty much seen, Legendary that is, as a Chinese company at this point.
That's right. Legally, perhaps it's U.S., but technically, you know, yeah. In all but spirit, it's Chinese.
Correct.
I may have said that wrong. Speaking of toxic, don't say the N-word.
No. In fact, we cannot stress this highly enough. You really just shouldn't say the N-word. Unless, I guess, you're a rapper, in which case you're allowed to say it in certain contexts, i.e. your songs. But
well, you're allowed to say it if you're a black person.
Okay.
That's all. It's not complicated. It's not, there's not a, it's like, black people can call themselves whatever they like. They can use it in any context they want. Everybody else, no go. You know, you're not Italian, don't say WAP. You're not Jew, don't say kike. I mean, you know, these words, don't say them. If you're in that group, I guess you've got the ability to write. Most of the time, you won't want to, but that's the rule. You know, don't use slurs about other ethnic groups of anybody.
Well, now it's that I know all of this, hold on. I'm just, where's my phone?
Write it down. Yeah.
Hold on. I'm just scrolling through my contacts. Vigo. Oh, there he is.
Right. So Oscar nominated screenwriter Terry Rossio got in a Twitter battle about vaccinations. He's an anti-vaxxer, which means he's a moron who ignores the science and how over the last 150 years, vaccinations have saved literally hundreds of millions of lives and protect children and people. Nonetheless, he's an anti-vaxxer, and in arguing and fighting with people online, he basically said calling someone an anti-vaxxer or mocking those people who oppose vaccinations is just as awful as calling someone the N-word, except he used the N-word. And people said, A, bad comparison, and B, don't do that. So he apologized and took it down, but he proved he was a moron in two different ways. And he felt really bad and he apologized. And then he indeed set up lunch with Viggo Mortensen so they could commiserate.
Yes, because of course Viggo Mortensen did that while doing press for Green Book.
Right, but which I would like to point out, the reason I brought this up, because it's so unimportant other than Terry Rossio's an idiot, is the fact that people keep referring to Viggo Mortensen and saying the controversy of Viggo Mortensen using the N-word. Or will Viggo Mortensen using the N-word hurt his Oscar chances? People, that is not a fair description of what happened. Viggo Mortensen did not use a racial slur. Viggo Mortensen was decrying racism and in doing so talked about one of the words that people don't use anymore. And he used that word. But that's very different from just using a slur.
Yeah,
it really is. And I, you know, when you just see a headline, or both Variety and Hollywood Reporter have done this, they just repeat Viggo Mortensen used the N-word. It's like, no. Viggo Mortensen was decrying racism and awkwardly used a phrase that he was pointing out as being awful. That is not the same as making a racial slur. And they really, it's not fair to him, I think, to keep repeating it and implying that that's what he did.
Yeah, in a way, he was kind of saying it. And having interviewed Viggo Mortensen many times, he is incredibly thoughtful. And I can say that he was saying it in a more academic way.
We know it. We don't need to have interviewed him. We know the quotes from the thing. He was saying it's a terrible word. We don't use it. For example, nobody uses the N-word anymore, except he said it, which he shouldn't have done. But it was not in any way, shape, or form animus or hatred or vileness that people usually use when they use that word. So repeating that Viggo used the N-word. No, he didn't. Not in the way that implies. You have to have the context, I think, to be fair.
Right. And to be fair, the context of both Universal and Warner Brothers saying, hey, we want a grand bargain for shorter theatrical release windows and that we're actually working on this now. The context is they're both owned by telecom giants.
Well, but they wanted that anyway, right? I mean, Fox, was they owned by a telecom giant?
No, and they have always been kind of wishy-washy on the subject. Fox, that is.
Oh, I thought they were in the shortened window side.
I think they were more in the, if we can make a deal, great, we're all for it. Certainly Lachlan Murdoch was. He definitely was. The studio heads, on the other hand, were like, oh, really, you're going to bring this
The point
this
of this discussion is that Variety says studios are poised again to push for shortened theatrical windows. NATO's John Fithian says, that's news to us.
Yes.
And since Disney took over Fox, that takes them out of the mix because Disney is very much not interested in shortening the windows. So there doesn't seem to be any real news hook to this other than Variety hinting, no, they really want to do this. Warner Brothers and Universal are still excited to do it. But with ticket sales maybe lagging a little bit, but box office doing really well, does shortening windows encourage people to go to the movies? I mean, why are they pushing for this? Why is there any reason this would happen again right now? It seems to me like it ain't broke, don't fix it, right?
I feel like a kid in class going, ooh, pick on me, I know the answer. Ooh, I know the answer.
Tell us the answer.
Okay, so this happens to kind of come up right after Warner Brothers acquires... Sorry, right after AT&T acquires Warner Brothers.
Ah, right.
Okay.
So they're like,
so this is a story placed with Brent Lang over at Variety by Warner Brothers to say, nope, we're going for it. And they got Universal to jump on board as well. Why? Because, you know, Universal's like, well, okay, sure. If you guys are going to fight for it and it's a story.
Because they want movies to stream online rather than in theaters because AT&T can make money.
Right, exactly. And so can Comcast, which owns Universal. However, none of the other studios, I think all the other studios are like,
but Disney will have their own platform, so they could make money if they streamed it as well. They're just saying, but we're doing so well at the box office. We have 40% of it. We don't see the need to fiddle with this. And my point is, lately, when I look at movies coming out on DVD or Blu-ray, that sad old relic of the past, I feel like they come out so soon. You know, I'm getting stuff that came out in August and July. You know, it feels like they come out just a minute later. I mean, 12 weeks after a movie debuts is awfully short window.
It really is. And to be honest with you, I've been on a lot of planes lately, and I'm watching, you know, these movies that are still in theaters. Now, I realize that's one of the things that, you know, they have that kind of airline window that is like, I think about 2 months after the film is in theaters,
right.
And it's a very limited audience. But that theatrical window, what Disney is saying is, hey, we're going to make, you know, between $4 and $6 billion with that. Yes, we're going to have our own streaming service, but you know what we're going to have on that streaming service? Big blockbuster titles. And you know what makes them blockbuster titles? Having them make $4 to $6 billion in movie theaters. That's what makes them blockbuster titles.
The only reason for a shortened window that I see is flops. I don't think you want every movie to come out, you know, what is it? How four does it? You know, I think if you've released Robin Hood and you've spent all that money in advertising and it's flopped, I completely understand saying, hey, look, it's out of the theaters. It's not making any money. Let us put it shorten the window for this flop and you'll get a cut of the box office. Okay. Same thing with the Nutcracker and the Four Realms. Hey, it flopped. Nobody's seen it in the theater, but you still have a little bit of name recognition. Throw it online quicker. That makes sense to me. But the idea that you have to do that with every movie rather than a case-by-case basis, I don't get it. You're sure as heck not going to want to rush Venom into streaming. You're not going to want to rush Dr. Seuss's The Grinch or Bohemian Rhapsody or Ralph Breaks the Internet. So, okay, for flops, I get it. But even there, is it that important? You're going to see it in more weeks anyway.
Yeah, but nobody wants to say, oh, yeah, no, it went, you know, after its first 2 weeks, it kind of...
That's what happens. Movies disappear. It's what happens all the time.
Well, certainly what happens in television. You know, that's why they say, oh, they picked up the back nine. Yeah, because they ordered 13 episodes. The network watched, is it a hit or not? And if it's a hit, guess what? We're picking up the full season of 22 episodes. Of course, now no season is 22 episodes, but still, you know, they still call it the back nine.
All I know is that I heard my friend's son call Warner Brothers Warner Bros. And I thought that was hilarious. And I haven't stopped saying it in my head every time I read Warner Brothers. I also know that Venom was a big hit in the Middle Kingdom in China, wasn't it?
Yes, we talked about that.
But what does that prove? We've moved on to China and the Middle Kingdom. What does that prove about Hollywood movies in China? They need them. Right.
Well, yeah, because, you know, China is, there's so much going on in China. It's like, where do you even start with China?
Start with the fact that Hollywood movies are very much welcome. The barriers have fallen. There may be some, you know, four-walling, or they sell a movie outright, or they co-produce it to pretend it's a Chinese movie rather than just a Hollywood film. But the fact is, they got a lot of movie theaters. They want big movies, and Hollywood's got them. And whether or not there's a slowdown in production in China, as there is, thanks to the tax crackdown, they're going to need Hollywood movies year round. And so, you know, those doors are going to just keep opening up wider and wider. But the box office is doing good in China, isn't it?
Yes, it's up 11% this year. And by the way, can I just point out, who predicted that that China would come around and say, Hollywood, keep sending us your hits. Keep sending
us. Well, we did.
Yes, exactly. Thank you very much. Right here.
Yeah. So their box office is up 11% so far. They're going to have a great year. North American box office, however, is up maybe 9 or 10%. So this year, China's not gaining any ground on us, are they?
Yeah, that's correct. I think we're going to maybe hit between $11.5 and $12 billion. So there's still about $4 billion separating China and the U.S. And of course, everybody's talking about, you know, for the last umpteen years, and by umpteen, I mean like 5 to 7, when China's box office will surpass North America's.
Well, I think that just got pushed back a little bit farther.
Maybe a year. Yeah.
No, I think longer than a year.
Well,
I mean,
I'm hedging my bets.
They're not going to do it. They're not going to grow 50% next year.
No, I'm hedging.
Right. So it's going to be, you know, we were talking about 6 months, 8 months, a year or two. We got caught up in the hype as well. But it's going to be quite a few years. You just have to remember, North American is a really weird market where people love going to the movies. This is the number one movie going market in the world. Not just because, you know, it hits above its weight. Yeah, it's a big market with 300 million people. But even if you make a European market of 300 million people, we're bigger. They just go to a lot of movies in the U.S. China may be fully screened right now for people with money. So there isn't a lot of growth to be had in just adding more screens.
You know, so they've got- you say that, but when I came out of A Star Is Born at the Landmark on the west side of Los Angeles, granted, I did see it in the middle of the day. During the screening, there was somebody coming in and with her walker saying, wait, where's my seat? Where's my seat? And then people were like, ugh. When I came out, I thought, wow, look at all these old people. And then I realized, you know, I'm probably among them. But still, I said...
It's the middle of the day.
It was like 5 o'clock at that point.
That's when old people go to the movies.
Fine.
So you're old.
I'm old.
But the Golden Horse Awards are also old. Those are the Asian equivalent to the Oscars. They're hosted by Taiwan. That's that country's awards. But they are given out to movies all over Asia. And they had their 55th annual ceremony on November 18th.
You know what? If they're 55, that makes me younger than the Taiwan Golden Horse Awards.
There you go. And this year, we don't care about who won this or that award. The big news was that a few speeches referenced Taiwan's independence. Basically the winner of the Best Documentary Award said something pretty modest like, I hope Taiwan's independence can be recognized and we can all live in peaceful, loving harmony. Something like that. But, the multiple references to Taiwan independence really sent shockwaves through the audience of Chinese actors. They got really wary. Gong Li chaired the jury, but she refused to go on stage to announce the final winner, because it came right after that documentary speech.
Yes, in fact, she could be seen running for the door.
Pretty much, really?
I'm kidding.
Oh, you're kidding, okay. Many, if not most, mainland Chinese actors skipped the celebratory dinner, which is sort of like the equivalent to the governor's ball. Many of the parties afterwards were canceled outright. And what I'd love to know one thing is, was there a divide between Chinese people who are living in Hong Kong and mainland Chinese actors? That would be sort of interesting. And now there's talk that China may ban people from taking part in the Golden Horse Awards at all. Now, that went from a headline saying China has done it to stories saying there were rumors that China might do it to now they're not even saying the rumors. They're just saying, well, it's a possibility. China might just tell people not to take part next year. And that's what happens when you live in a totalitarian government. They didn't have to pick up the phone and tell Gong Li, don't go on stage. People censor themselves. They're afraid to say things. They're afraid to do things. They know, I might get in trouble for this. I better just not do it because it's safer. And that's what happens when you live in a government and a country like that. China's a great country, great people, great culture. But it's a stark reminder of the government that they live under.
And there, when I was in Dubai, I could tell you that, you just don't say anything bad about the UAE while you're there.
Oh, well, certainly not.
Yeah.
I love Stalin.
He said while in Moscow.
I do love my Cinemia, my movie subscription pass.
And that's what you're liking that, huh?
It has its problems, but I'm liking it better and better. And I think we should now call this the movie subscription section.
Yeah, because you know what? I can tell you this. Covering this industry, the motion picture exhibition or cinema space and distribution space, I can tell you that more movie-going subscription services are on the way, mostly from different
other chains,
different theater chains. Yes, because it's so hard to do it as a third party.
But I do not want a theater chain pass. I have no interest in buying an AMC or Regal pass, unless I guess I live in a small area where there are no independent chains. You know, there are no art houses and stuff. Maybe it makes sense there. But if I'm in an area like Birmingham, Alabama, where the basic game is AMC, and I can go to $5 Tuesdays, why should I pay $20 for a pass? I can just go on Tuesdays and see four movies, one movie a week.
Right.
You know, it just doesn't make sense to me. But an industry-wide pass really works. You've got MoviePass. You used it this weekend, so you're still happy. How's MoviePass doing?
Yeah, not well, actually. Not well at all. I was looking because I was, traveling over the Thanksgiving break. And I was looking to see, like, okay, what can I see in upstate New York? Yeah, Suspiria. I could see that movie.
But before you get too excited about The Favorite, Suspiria had the best per screen average of the year until The Favorite came out. Mind you, The Favorite has gotten much better reviews. But I'm just saying, let's see how it spreads when it opens wider. I'm sure it'll do much better than Suspiria, but those limited releases can be tricky. But you didn't want to go see Suspiria. Go figure.
No, and even if I did want to see it, even if it was the one movie this year that I wanted to see, okay, it was not playing in upstate New York. So it's very nice that they're letting me see that movie, and they're letting me see The Favorite. I think it was The Favorite. Or no, The Countess is what they were allowing me to see. However, those movies are playing in New York and Los Angeles, okay? So that's actually kind of misleading. And
annoying.
It's very annoying. And I can tell you, based on the comments of the Wall Street Journal article about MoviePass losing $137 million during its last quarter, being unable to raise more funds, the spinoff of MoviePass being now kind of canceled. They were trying to spin it off from Helios and Matheson as a way to raise more funds. Its stock prices, Helios's stock price is now 2 cents per share. The comments on that story were just scathing because people like me who bought the entire year, you know, for $89 at Costco, were all saying,
you've probably gotten your money back by now.
Yeah, you know what?
Did before? Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of went, look, I've seen 12 movies with the thing. So the way I look at it is,
that's it?
It's, well, yeah.
That's
because,
all?
Well, think about it. Until they started.
Oh, God, I saw like 50.
Well, you're the reason that they only have 3 movies a month now.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, realize for people like me who, you know, have kids and, you know, and are just kind of, you know, they're over the age of 25, basically, is what I'm trying to say. You're over the age of 25. I'm over the age of 25. It's hard to go see movies. Apparently not for you, though.
No, not for me. Not for people who are big on movies. No, it was a great deal. If they could pay $10 a month, it's great. But they are helping people not see movies. They put out some stats saying that in March, people were going to over 2 movies on average a month. In August, they got that down to 0.85 movies, less than 1 movie a month. In September, it's dropped even further to 0.77 movies a month. You're seeing 3/4 of a movie each month. So the average, basically, they've made it really hard for you to see a movie. So what turns out, MoviePass, good at 2 things. One, getting people to go see a lot of movies. Here's a pass, $10 a month, knock yourself out. The other thing they're really good at, telling people they can't go to the movies. They're really good at that too. All right, you can see this movie on Tuesday in another city at noon. That's it. So those are both great, but neither of them is a profitable business.
Yeah, well,
Cinemia is really stepping up the game. They see themselves as a competitor. They believe they're already pulling up people, and they are improving their service in multiple ways. They did an email saying, here are all the things we're changing, and basically addresses almost every complaint I have. They're adding back physical cards so you can avoid online fees. They're giving every customer their own unique credit card number, which means it'll be easier to buy tickets online. You won't have to cut and paste the info every single time. And they're trying to strike deals with chains, probably small chains, just like MoviePass did to start with, so that you don't have to pay any fee at all. So they're going to make it a lot easier for people to go see movies all the time, save some fees. So everything Cinemia is doing is quick and smart to address the complaints I had when I started using it. But even with the pain in the neck stuff and even paying a $3 to $4 fee each time you see a movie, it's still a good deal.
Okay. You pay a $3 fee every time you see a movie?
Well, you can. If you have to buy a ticket online, which you have to do every single time right now, you pay $1 or $1.50, you know, for Atom tickets or whatever the movie ticket plan is. Plus, Cinemia charges you $1.80 every time you buy a ticket. So they're just trying to, you know, not lose money. You know, they're saying, yeah, I know it's $30 a month, but we're still losing money if you go to a lot of movies. So they're trying to just sort of, you know, build in some things to ameliorate that. But you know what? Once they get rid of the outside fees, paying $1.80 for a movie ticket, you know, that's still cheap compared to $15.
Yeah, but you're also paying $30.
Yeah, yes. But I'm saying you're paying $30 a month to have access to as many movies as you want for $1.80 each. That's a deal I'll take if I'm in a big city and paying a high ticket price and have access to a lot of different theaters.
Well, I know that Cinemia is ramping up some other projects that I'm sure they're going to be announcing shortly. I know the credit card thing, it's all about fraud protection. And I think that's why they didn't give out physical cards at first. And now
they had physical cards and they got rid of them.
Yes.
And then they did it. But the fraud protection, but it was just too difficult.
Correct.
It made it too much of a pain for people to use.
Correct. Well, and Michael, I don't know how you find time to go to the movies because you're supposed to be actually not going to the movies, okay? You should be at home reading every single book that is published this year so that you can tell us which books we should be reading on Book Filter, okay? That's what Book Filter does, and this must mean it's time for our Book Filter news. And every week in our Book Filter segment, you come to us with a new book that's ready for its close-up, whether it's a TV series or a movie adaptation. You tell us what book the industry should be looking at. And this week, you know, they should be looking at it if only to read the book before the movie comes out. What have you got for us this week?
That's right. It's already been a hot property. My Sister, the Serial Killer by Oyinkan Braithwaite. It's a Nigerian black comedy about a nurse. She's sort of plain looking, and she has a sister who's very hot and sexy. And the nurse is very sober, and there's one doctor at work that she really likes. He's handsome, but he doesn't really pay attention to her except professionally. But she fantasizes about him as being her future husband. Her sister, meanwhile, has issues of intimacy. Not sex. She likes sex. But when her boyfriends try to get serious and talk about marriage, she freaks out and she kills them. Oops. And so
that went dark fast.
The nurse has to help her clean up and get rid of the bodies, and she's really tired of it. She's like, look, that's three guys now. Three means you're a serial killer. You need to watch this. And then she finds out her sister has just met the doctor of her dreams. Now she's really scared because what does she do? Her sister might date him, and then she'll have to kill him. And she likes the doctor herself, and it all goes on from there. But this book is a hot property. The author's been interviewed on NPR, articles in the New York Times, been optioned for movies by Working Title and Big Talk months before it was published. So this is a pick that we had, and then we saw everybody else is on top of it as well. Like Michelle Obama, I guess.
Yeah. Now, by the way, before we get to Michelle Obama, that book, My Sister, the Serial Killer, the author, Ms. Braithwaite, did not like the title. However, was convinced to go with it, and she wrote it in 1 month.
Well, there you go.
Michelle Obama took 8 years to write her book, actually.
Well, it took 8 years to live it. It's her bio. It's her memoirs, especially in the White House. I think it's her childhood, too.
Yes, I know. I just, 8 years, the presidency, Michelle Obama. You know, I'm just trying to link things here.
So this had a huge first week. It sold 1.4 million copies in its first week. That's the most of any publisher for any book in 2018, bigger than Bob Woodward's Fear. It's the biggest week for an adult title, period, since Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman a few years ago, and that was a hugely anticipated book. And it continues the trend of anti-Trump books dominating the charts. Apparently, if you read, you don't like Trump.
Well, was this anti-Trump so much? I mean, I don't think she like went after Trump per se, did she?
No, but it's a positive depiction of a person that is the polar opposite of Trump. So it's a book. It's not a book taking down Trump, but it's a book that people who don't like Trump go, oh my God, remember when we had Michelle Obama as the first lady and how wonderful that was. It's clearly in the vein of all these books that are pro other people who are anti-Trump or in some way, shape or form reflecting on the animus towards the current White House. I don't think that's a stretch, no. Michelle Obama. But she certainly did finger out Trump and say how she will never forgive him for putting her family's life in danger. Yes. You know, constantly implying they weren't real Americans and, you know, denigrating their Obama citizenship and the fact that he was an American citizen and, you know, the death threats they got from crazy nutty people that Trump riled up with his racist, you know, lies about Obama's birthplace. So, yeah, she said, I will never forgive that man. And that was one of the big takeaways from the news media. But the book itself is essentially positive and about her life, not about Trump.
Well, I don't know whether the next bit of news, it stays with book news, okay? But I don't know whether it's positive or not. I'm going to let you tell me. It's kind of sexual misconduct news, which, we had as a segment for quite a while. And we haven't had too many news stories to report about. And I want to say thank goodness in a way, because, you know, maybe people...
Again, you shouldn't say that. Sexual misconduct has not gone away. There have been some legal issues around Harvey Weinstein and some cases falling apart and this and that. But, you know, we've had sort of a pause in the holidays. There hasn't been a really big story, and it's not our beat as such.
Correct.
But I felt like since we talked about author Junot Diaz before and charges that he faced, that it was only fair to say that he's been cleared by another group that he's associated with. He sits on the board of the Pulitzers, the prize-winning people, and they did an independent investigation and announced that he would be staying on the board. They found no misbehavior from Diaz as it relates to his work at the Pulitzers. You know, he's been cleared by most everyone that he was connected to. MIT investigated it. They found he did not abuse his position there. Boston Review kept him on as a fiction editor, though two other editors quit in protest. So, you know, most of the accusations against him were basically he was behaving like a jerk. I don't think that's a mischaracterization.
No, in fact, I think that most of those characterizations came from him. He's the first person to say, no, I'm not very easy to get along
with. Right, but as we learned from Louis C.K. and others, that doesn't mean it's okay to be a jerk.
No, that is correct.
So we don't know. We just know, look, people have been complaining, oh, it's a witch hunt. Well, here's a case where whatever the truth of the matter is and how what kind of a person he is in his personal life, there were accusations made against him, which may be completely true. But people caught their breath. They look into it. And his life has not been destroyed simply by the fact that somebody said he was a bad person. So, you know, the system is working, not in the sense that this was right or wrong, but in the sense that people can find a balance and not rush to judgment. We'll have to see what it's like the next time he puts a book out, how he's treated. I'm sure he'll have to address it even more. But guess what? Life is complicated. So I think this is a win in the sense of people are not, you know, being tossed to the curb, you know, like Sherman Alexie. He's a very powerful person in his community, and hopefully he respects that and understands that, and it won't excuse any bad behavior, but nor should you have to pretend their great work was never existing and ignore their books or ignore them forever afterwards just because somebody accused them of something. You know, you want sexual misconduct to come to light. You want people to pay a price. You also want a balance.
Now, I have to say, I learned about this news this week from you, actually, in our show notes. Now, that said, when these accusations were first made, it was all over the place.
Well, not hugely, no. I mean, Juno Diaz is not exactly a massive name, but this is the third step. So I think the actions by Boston Review were covered more widely. I think the MIT investigation was covered more widely. This is so tangential, the Pulitzer board. There was no suggestion that he had done anything inappropriate connected to the Pulitzers. Therefore, I think that investigation got the least amount of attention, and now the result has gotten the least amount of attention. But yes, people like a scandal more than they like innocence. That's why we felt the need to talk about it.
And they like a big deal more than they like a big whoop. And in fact, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Springsteen, What Hath Thou Wrought? The Boss has been having a grand time on Broadway and making good coin, despite the intimate setting. He has also been telling superstar friends the stint on Broadway has been a career peak for him. Now others want to get in on the act. A group of music industry heavyweights like Live Nation and Creative Artists Agency are circling Broadway houses. Their plan is to bring in musical acts to play Broadway for multiple week stints of, you know, 3 weeks or so. Celebs get the fun of playing Broadway, usually in trimmed down versions of their touring show, and audiences get the chance to see big acts in an intimate setting rather than in a stadium. They don't want to charge more than, say, $500 a ticket, unless, of course, demand just forces their hand. You can be sure Netflix and live concerts will be in the mix, too, just like Springsteen. Barbara Streisand, Beyonce, Lionel Richie, Ariana Grande, James Taylor, they're just some of the acts repped by the companies involved who might want to hit the Great White Way to get a little green. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I think anytime a big star plays Broadway, they can draw an audience. We've seen it before, but Springsteen has certainly pointed the way towards a whole new flood of it. I thought they were going to buy a Broadway house and just do it permanently, but this seems to be like they're sort of just, you know, renting the house and going to try to do it for like a year and see how it works. I guess they'll keep extending it. You know, it worked. I'm sure it's foolproof. If the Stones want to play a Broadway house, if U2 wants to play a Broadway house, if Beyonce or even Lionel Richie or Ariana Grande, they want to sit on a Broadway house for 3 weeks, they'll sell out. They'll sell a lot of tickets. The thing I would warn, though, and that'll be profitable, it'll be fine. But Springsteen crafted a particular show, and he went to great effort to create some unique event. It isn't just a concert done in a smaller setting. So it's not the same as what those other people are doing. For them, it's more like playing the Apollo. You know, you got roots in black music, or you want to celebrate black artists. Playing the Apollo is a really cool thing to do. So is playing Broadway. But, you know, Streisand, you know, come on now. She's not going to do just 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And Broadway is hot. Harry Potter, of course, we just had the Thanksgiving holiday. That's a huge week for theater going. We don't have all the numbers yet, but we know Harry Potter set a record, $2.3 million over the Thanksgiving week. That's the highest one-week gross ever for a Broadway play. Mean Girls set a record for its house. And in the opposite span, Head Over Heels, that Go-Go musical, is closing January 6th. We knew that was only a matter of time.
Yes, the Go-Go's from the 1980s. I can't imagine why that didn't work. Now, that brings us to the International Emmys, which were truly, this year, international. Seemingly every country won at least one top prize. Hey, wait, actually, if that's the case, did Oprah hand these out? Because you could just see her going, you get an Emmy, Israel, and you get an Emmy, Peru, and you get an Emmy, Argentina. I don't know, I just picked like names out of South America and the Middle East, I don't know. So Israel, in fact, did win Best Comedy with Nevsu, and Spain won Best Drama with Money Heist. The UK won Best Miniseries with Man in an Orange Shirt, and Portugal won Best Telenovela with The Payback. Belgium won Best Non-Scripted with Did You Get the Message? I've heard, by the way, of literally none of these, but you can bet they're streaming on a website near you, or at least will be soon, and English language remakes might just be in the works. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, I guess, in the scheme of things, but I wish the Emmys, the American Emmys, got more attention as well. I think it's a great way to know which shows to watch. And that's exactly what we've done with the International Emmys for years. So these are on my list. And it's a small world. I went to Cannes, met a friend who lives in Israel. His teacher in Israel, who liked his work, worked on Nevsu, the Best Comedy winner. So I'm one step away from her and Kevin Bacon.
Okay. I'm not going to go down that path. Now, remember the role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons, Michael?
Of course.
Well, kids don't just remember it these days. They're playing it. The official D&D game had perhaps its best year ever in terms of sales. At the very least, it's the best year since new owners bought the game some 20 years ago, back in 1997. About 8.6 million people played the game in the last 12 months. Millions more watch other people play the game via streaming, and that doesn't even include unofficial spin-offs like Pathfinder, an easier-to-play version, and Starfinder, the game set in space. Many-sided dice have never been cooler. By the way, if you have no idea what that last reference was to, congratulations, you probably had friends in high school. Big deal or big whoop.
I never played the game. But again, my friend's son, Adrian, who said Warner Bros., he also has been playing this game for like the last year with friends online. They also basically stream together, and there's the Dungeon Master rolling the dice for everyone. And they're not together in the same room, but they play together. So they're friends from college who are, you know, now dispersed, but they continue playing together every week online. So it's not the same thing as watching other people play like we were talking about, but that's the potential of technology to allow people to do stuff like this, even when they're in different cities. But one big reason for the success, we've seen a trending upwards in this game for a few years, so it's not the sole reason, but Stranger Things certainly didn't hurt.
That's true, actually, because, of course, they played Dungeons & Dragons in that show.
Absolutely.
It's like Reese's Pieces and E.T.
Delicious!
YouTube is getting into movies. No, they're not making movies, but they are showing them for free. Click on YouTube and you can find some classic films like Rocky, Legally Blonde, and The Terminator free to watch on YouTube. Oh, by the way, there are ads, and no, you can't skip them. But hey, the movie is free. It's like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, remember that? Television, actually.
Over-the-air television, yeah. We should say.
The offerings are few, just 100 or so, and most aren't that big. The offerings, that is. But if it works, you can expect more. Big deal or big whoop?
It's probably a big whoop, right? You know, they got about 100 movies up there. They'll see how it works. No reason why they shouldn't do it. It makes sense. But here's a fun Easter egg. Warner Brothers put the entire first Lego movie as a trailer before some videos. So you're going to click on Watch a Cat video, and then you get a trailer. You get an ad pops up, and the stars of the movie pop up and say, hey, keep watching. Don't stop. Keep watching this. Don't skip this. Sad. So there's the little ad, but then they show the entire film in the ad. So you can watch the entire movie for 100 minutes, and then your 3-minute cat video pops in. That's kind of hilarious.
Well, it seems like everyone wants more video. The streaming music service Spotify wanted to get into the video game, but its earlier efforts stumbled. Now it's making some key hires again, with Sarah El-Habashi of Condé Nast laying money down as Spotify's new content VP. Some production companies say they've been approached about doing video projects, but this time the programming is very music-centric. Probably a smart idea, actually. It's like, what's the name I'm looking for? Like the last one was, it's like music television, actually. Is this a big deal or big whoop?
I would say this is a big whoop. The big deal would be if they weren't trying to get into video.
Yeah, true. But then there's going to be fraud, right? Because, you know, one reason everyone wants to get into video is because it's so popular. Add in videos to your mix, find a hit concept, and you'll attract eyeballs. How do we know? Because advertisers and folks like Nielsen are adding up said eyeballs, which actually is kind of gross if you think about it. Just the eyeball. It turns out tracking online audiences is really hard. One big reason? Fraud. Bots are streaming all over the net, and it's not just automated bots doing their thing. It's an attempt by someone to game the system and get more money for the ads they're carrying. So if you can get an ad and then artificially drive up traffic, you get more money. The jump in fraud has been substantial, at least according to one study by a company paid to verify online audiences, and they point to a sophisticated new bot network. Their specialty is tracking audiences watching connected TV, which apparently means Hulu and the like, but one can assume the problem doesn't stop there. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. People are actually aggressively trying to defraud advertisers by pretending they're getting a bigger audience than they have. But I also think it raises the question of how popular is all this stuff that people think it is online. You know, we've seen so much gaming of the system with people buying likes and buying friends and buying audiences that I just feel like the whole thing is a mess. You know, I just don't know what to believe. And, you know, some people like that. They want you to question everything. But we want accurate representation of what's actually popular, and that's getting harder and harder to do. I'm wary of this particular study because it comes from people being paid to pay attention to this stuff. So they have a game and saying, hey, it's really important and we're doing a good job. But I'm looking for more information like this from other sources because it's very interesting.
We can assume the Oscars will be a little suspenseful this year since 2018 hasn't yet produced a dominating Titanic-like film prepared to sweep. It's anyone's night to win. Not so for the Game Awards, which will be announced December 6th. True, the blockbusters God of War and Red Dead Redemption 2 tied with 8 nominations in all. And while God of War got great reviews, we're headed to Vegas and we're laying down our money on the Western Redemption to snag the top honor, Game of the Year. Actor Tobey Maguire has never received an Oscar nomination for anything, much less playing Spider-Man. Remember, he played Spider-Man.
Of course.
But Yuri Lowenthal got a nod for his performance in Marvel's Spider-Man, the video game. Other categories include Best Ongoing Game, Best Mobile, Best Indie Game, and so on. By the way, can we actually really make money betting on Red Dead Redemption 2? Because if so, I'm going to Vegas, actually. Okay. So, by the way, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Just answer that first, and then we'll go to Vegas.
I think you could probably make a bet on it in the UK. They let you bet on everything. I don't know if Vegas has lines or odds on video game awards. They might. I don't know how to check that up, but you should, because I would bet on it. You know, get the odds while they're still good. You know, I was in Nashville. Again, back to Adrian, Warner Bros. The bro was playing Red Dead Redemption 2 in the living room, in the den, so I got to watch Red Dead Redemption 2 for like an hour at a time. It's pretty cool. I mean, the graphics are amazing. He loves the game, been playing it a lot. There's just endless storylines to explore. You're doing this, you're doing that, you're doing the other thing. It was really, really interesting. He thinks it's great, and our friend Jeff Boucher, who's on the show, I asked him if he was a big gamer and what he thought of it. He said he's not, but his son is. I think his kid's like 8 or something. I told him to ask his son what he thought of Red Dead Redemption 2, and he said, it's better than good. It's better than great. It's just amazing.
I actually almost got an Xbox on Black Friday just to play this game.
Well, that's cool. Well, you're not the only one, because video game sales, they just had their best October ever. And that's spreading. People are playing video games and they're making money at it. There's a tournament that was just announced where people can win like a $1 million prize, people playing online. And now, of course, colleges are competing in esports along with football and hockey and tennis and everything else. They're competing in esports, and they're even offering modest scholarships to esport athletes. And they even have their equivalent of the NCAA now. It's called the National Association of Collegiate Esports. Esports and video games, have been here for a long time, and they're bigger than ever.
And, you know, the one problem with esports is you just never know with the injuries, those thumb tendons always getting pulled.
Carpal tunnel syndrome, yeah, man, it's a thing. Yeah. And Stane, you want to be healthy to play chess.
Yes,
you know,
true.
Got an exciting chess match going on. That you, sometimes one of the last matches, the guy lost like 30 pounds during the 5 or 7 days or 10 days they were playing. These can be very stressful and physically exhausting. The healthier you are, the better you will compete. So laugh all you want, monkey boy, but being fit is important.
If you can guess the reference, that please call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or reach out to us on Twitter, where our handle is at Showbiz Sandbox. Like us on Facebook, where our page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. And of course, our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And you can, of course, let us know where that reference monkey boy comes from. In the meantime, Jimmy Fallon and Stephen Colbert are locked in a death struggle. Okay. Well, okay. Well, actually, neither one of them has to die, but they would both like to be the king of late night. What about me? Says Jimmy Kimmel. You know what they say? Shut up. You've got the Oscars. So Colbert is by far and away the most popular late night host, with a massive 1 million more viewers tuning into his program than Fallon. However, Fallon remains number one in the key 18 to 49 demo. Barely. He's barely number one in that demo. He leads in the demo by just 2,000 viewers. Now, Fallon has hired away Jim Bell of the Today Show to be his showrunner to give him an edge, and Stephen Colbert wants a recount. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because Colbert is a big leader in overall numbers, and he's closing in on the key demo. So soon he will be having bragging rights, period, unless Jim Bell can turn it around for Jimmy Fallon. You know, the trending has not been good for Fallon, and I think that's just going to continue. But to me, to heck with Jimmy Fallon or Jimmy Kimmel or Stephen Colbert or James Corden. Jerry, in daytime,
God.
Jerry Springer is coming back to television after his, you know, long-running schlockfest closed, you know, after like, what, 20, 30 years of being on in daytime syndication. He's returning as Judge Jerry Springer, because who better to adjudicate cases than Jerry Springer?
Is he going to have a bouncer?
Probably.
Security guards. Turner Media wanted to pound the drum for its platform, Bleacher Report. Oh, this story is just classic. They wanted to show the world how great it would be for presenting live events. Okay, so they created one from scratch. It was a showdown between golfers Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods. You know, it was about 15 years past when that, you know, showdown should have happened, but still.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything went wrong. First, the match was boring until it got kind of interesting towards the very end when there was a playoff. As an announcer, Charles Barkley did noble work trying to keep things funny. Far worse, from Turner's point of view, the much-vaunted Bleacher Report platform had multiple technical issues. People who paid $20 were having trouble logging in, and others were having trouble paying. In a last-minute audible, they decided to take down the paywall, rather than have some customers who forked out money be unable to watch the golf. So everyone got to watch the shootout. Bleacher Report gave refunds to anyone that paid directly through their site. Comcast gave a credit to anyone who bought it through them. And Mickelson said, I still get my $9 million winnings, right? Yes, indeed he does. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. They had a crisis, and I think they definitely made the right call, both in opening it up to everyone and giving a refund. They just have to swallow the losses that they had. They really were trying to promote it. So that's a disaster, because no matter what you say, promoting Bleacher Report failed miserably because they did a terrible job technically. So that's awful. But in terms of what happened that day, people were a little annoyed or irked, but they got their money back, or at least they got a credit. That's better than having them festering and angry over what happened, or having people blocked out who tried to pay. So I think they made the right call.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think it's, you know what? They stumbled out of
a terrible situation. Yeah.
And there was nothing they could do. I mean, once you realize, look, we're going down in flames, you may as well just open it up.
Yeah, it only benefited the people who didn't want to pay, but were kind of interested. So it's a pretty small audience that got a freebie anyway.
Right. As opposed to me, who went, oh, is that when it was on Friday? I didn't know when that thing was taking place. Now that brings us to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're going to talk about music, specifically the collapse of physical album sales. You know, vinyl LPs, CDs, digital albums, and the like. This could have a big effect on the industry and, of course, the art form. Young fans are getting out of the habit of sitting down and actually listening to an album, which means artists are getting out of the habit of, you know, creating them. Sure, they'll put out albums, but more and more often the big acts are keeping up a constant stream of singles and videos and live cuts and EPs and albums that all blend into one another. That's how their fans listen to music, so that's how the artists make it now. First, we'll take a look at the latest hit albums. I guess a publishing deal by Sony and Taylor Swift's remarkable new contract with Universal. It's not remarkable for what she got, of course, because she's Taylor Swift. It's remarkable for what she got other acts. This is pretty, I wanted to say remarkable, but since I've already said it three times, I can't say remarkable. It's pretty amazing. So Michael, while albums are still in existence, why don't you tell us which ones are topping the Billboard charts this week?
Well, Mumford & Sons is at number one, their third album in a row to hit number one. It's Delta. And we're looking at actual album sales. Of course, to be number one, they combine album sales and streaming. But for this week, the top five is mostly based on album sales anyway, actually. But they sold 214,000 actual copies of their new album, Delta, which I have to admit was a little disappointing when I listened to it on streaming. But there they are at number one. This was like the biggest album sales for an indie artist in 2 years, however they define that at Billboard. One of the biggest rock album debuts of the year in terms of 200,000 album sales being sold. That just tells you how far we've fallen, because that is not a huge big number by any stretch of the imagination, but it was enough to set records, you know, invest in years. So that tells you where we are. And number two is Michael Bublé with his new album Love, which sold 100,000 copies. And number three is The Greatest Showman Reimagined. This is that Greatest Showman soundtrack, but all the songs covered by big pop stars. So it's the soundtrack to the movie Reimagined. They sold 70,000 copies. And if there's any indication that a movie is a big property with a future life on Broadway or somewhere else, it has to be The Greatest Showman. This baby will not die. There's another soundtrack at number four, A Star is Born. Sperling saw the movie, and then he ran out and bought the album. Anyway, at number five is Mariah Carey with her new album, Caution. It's her 18th top 10 album, and she sold 40,000 copies. That's pretty mild, to say the least. And that gets her into the top five. So, you know, most of these acts I noted lean older. That's not true every week. Last week, Kane Brown, the young country act, was number one. But these guys lean older, and that probably explains why their fans showed up. They've got older fans who maybe actually want to buy an album rather than stream it. You're an older Michael Bublé fan, you just pick up the new CD at Walmart. It's getting harder and harder to find those albums, but people are still tracking them down.
Well, so albums still have, I guess, a little life left in them, and the guys from Mumford & Sons are good songwriters, at least for the first three songs on the album. So whether fans stream it or watch videos or buy albums or they get played on the radio, there is one thing that's true. Owning a piece of their publishing for Mumford & Sons would be a smart move. That's why Sony's publishing arm keeps getting bigger. There's golden in their publishing hills. So what happened with Sony?
Well, yeah, you know, the big lesson for the last 60 years of music is, hey, own your own publishing. Don't sell it away for a song, and own your own masters if you can do that. Ray Charles did that way back in the 60s when he went to a new label, and it was an unprecedented deal. Even Sinatra didn't get his own masters.
It was so unprecedented that when they did the biopic with Jamie Foxx, Ray, it was a part of the movie. Like him his master.
Yeah. It's a big ass deal. So, you know, publishing still matters a lot. And Sony just finalized its acquisition of EMI. They spent maybe $2.3 billion and took on another billion plus in debt. So it's like a $4 billion deal in all, I think. They already owned 40% of the company. They got another 50%. And then they scooped up the final 10% from the Michael Jackson estate. They got that final 10% for $287 million. And that means they now own 100% of it outright, and all the major countries and EU markets have signed off on it, so it's now official.
And Paul McCartney's going, oh, I didn't even know it was for sale.
Yeah, no, he's still furious he sold it to Michael Jackson. I can't blame him. Good businessman, but oh, he got screwed on that one. Yeah. He really should have coughed up extra money. I'm sure he's kicking himself. And if he had, I know he would not have sold it. There's no way he would give up his, you know, his copyrights. No way. Not till he died.
Now, certainly over the past couple of weeks and months, Taylor Swift was at the center of a major bidding war. Sometimes when this happens, it's an unproven artist or a veteran who is probably past their peak, and some wisely assume the money being spent is, well, not wise, I suppose. With Taylor Swift about to turn 29, okay, I would have thought she's 39 based on how long we've been hearing about her. She's turning 29 on December 13th. There's every reason to believe she's got a lot of career left in her. So what is going on with Taylor Swift? She's getting a new contract with Universal. She signed with Universal and its subsidiary. They were pretty much already handling much of Swift's career on a day-to-day level, right?
Right. Her major label, the label that broke her, was an indie called Big Machine, and they had a deal with distribution via Universal, and they have a lot of other big acts now too. So they haven't been sitting on their hands, but they had Taylor Swift. They loved her, and Universal was handling, and the subsidiary was handling like videos and marketing of singles and stuff like that. So it's not like Big Machine wasn't involved. It was just that, you know, they were part of this big conglomerate. Now they were an independent company, but, you know, Universal was handling stuff. So it's not that dramatic a shift. The only big problem was Taylor Swift wanted her masters. Big Machine said, no, that's the one valuable thing we have is your masters. We can't give them up. It would just be crazy. And so she said, fine, I'm going somewhere else. So she went with Universal. They looked at the numbers and they said, you know what? We can make a deal with her. We can have control of the masters for a number of years and we'll still make money. So that's why they signed off on the deal.
Now, okay, let's explain what masters are and why they're so important and why artists like Taylor Swift want to own them and why record companies would prefer to own them.
Well, it's the actual, it's like owning the movie. It's the actual album, the physical album. The masters are the recording of the album.
You so own the actual that. Tape, so to speak. I know, yeah. It's not tape now, yeah. But yeah, it's the
and,
actual
and meaning
tape.
The right to do whatever you want with them. You know, ultimately, if you own them, she's not going to own them right away. She can't just take it and do whatever she wants. But eventually, she'll take control of her masters, which means she can then put them out on her own. She can do box sets. She can do whatever she wants for the rest of her life and her descendants' lives and make money off of it, whereas the Universal will no longer have the right to put out that album. So Disney makes a movie, they make Ralph Breaks the Internet, they own it forever until it goes into the public domain. And even after that, there's value in knowing this is the Disney-approved version of Ralph Breaks the Internet, which will go into the public domain in 2470, I think, is the year that it will go into the public domain. So Taylor Swift will own her own album, and she can do whatever she wants with it. Not only has that always been meaningful, because Ray Charles made a ton of money off his masters, but it's even more meaningful today when it's easier than ever for you to put out your own music.
So the movie equivalent of this would be like selling the rights to your movie, okay, to Universal Pictures for North America to distribute in North America or even worldwide and saying, okay, you get the right to distribute this movie for, let's say, 10 years. All the DVDs, all the VHS tapes, all the streaming, it's all yours, okay, for 10 years. But I own the masters. I own the rights to the movie, okay? So I'm only giving it to you or I'm only selling it to you for 10 years. In the markets, yeah, that I'm selling it to you for.
That's what George Lucas did with Star Wars, prequels.
That is exactly what he did. He basically said, I own these. I'm paying for them, okay? And
he just rented out the studio for them to distribute. They just did it for a modest fee. They didn't make all the profit from the movie.
15% plus expenses. And I'm sure that 15% was lower, but yes.
Yeah. So there you go. Owning the masters is a big, big deal, and Universal agreed to it. But that wasn't it, was it?
No, the biggest deal, I think, because of course that had been done before, Ray Charles, we said it. It's especially notable because this is the first time that Swift, first of all, she's not a big player in streaming, okay, relatively speaking. She holds back her albums. We've talked about this on previous episodes. She holds them back with a window, and that urges fans to go out and buy them instead. And she would see a lot less money from streaming than many other acts. Further, she's one of the rare acts who wouldn't have some loans on her balance sheet. That's
now,
that.
Well, now you're getting ahead of yourself. Here it is. So Universal owns a chunk of Spotify, like all the other major labels did. They got a chunk of it
right
when they agreed to allow their music to be streamed. And in her contract, Swift demanded that if and when they sold their shares in Spotify or any other streaming service, she insisted on getting a cut that was non-recoupable. Now, two other labels have handed out money to artists. One of them said, hey, here's the money free and clear, your cut that we've determined you deserve. You know, the other one said, okay, here's money we're sort of giving you, but you know what? You owe us $800,000 for that album and that video that you recorded, so we're going to take it back.
Right.
She said, I want money, and I want it non-recoupable. I don't care what any loans you pretend I own. I want that money free and clear. That means getting a fair piece of the pie and without the label using that money to pay off any debt they claim the artist loans them. And Swift didn't insist on this just for herself. She insisted on this clause for every single act in Universal's roster.
Yes, that's pretty. I mean, it's outstanding. It blows my mind that she was able to get that because she
didn't need it because she's not going to have any debt. They're not going to pretend she owes them money because she's such a superstar act. That nonsense is over, or whatever it is. It's an accounting thing that will disappear quickly. She makes so much money, she doesn't need to worry about it, whether being it's recoupable or not. She doesn't have to worry about streaming because it's not as big a deal for her as a lot. I mean, it's big. She's number 18 on the list of top streaming artists, but she could be a lot bigger. So it's an area she doesn't care about, and the recoupable stuff doesn't affect her because she's such a superstar. It wouldn't affect you too either. And yet she insisted on it for everyone at Universal, and they said yes.
Well, and here's the thing, just to kind of explain what that means, the recoupable part. When an artist, a musician, gets a record deal, goes into the studio to record an album, the record company is paying for the studio time, paying for the engineer, paying for the producers, and they get to call certain shots. And so the studio says, look, on our balance sheet, we paid, hypothetical, $500,000 for you to record your album. And then we're going to distribute that album. That has some cost to it. We're going to market that album. That has some cost to it. So we're basically in the hole for $1 million on you. Okay.
But no, we're not in the hole. You're in the hole. That's the BS.
Correct.
It's as if you directed a movie for Universal and they said, oh, wow, you owe us $80 million. You're
correct.
Like, what? I directed a movie for you. You should be thanking me. Like, no, you owe us $80 million. Let's see how it does at the box office. And most musical acts never get out of debt with their label, like well over 90%, because most albums don't go multi-platinum or make a ton of money. And so you're basically in servitude to your label. That's why Prince wrote Slave on his face. He was annoyed about his contract with Warner Brothers. He wanted his own masters. And so, you know, it's actually a big fight that he had with them. So, you know, it's all malarkey. And so record labels like to pretend you're in debt to them when they're just doing what they always do, putting out albums from artists that they sign. So they sign you and they say, oh, we've loaned you $1 million. Enjoy the music video.
Yeah.
So it's all bull. But Taylor Swift said in this case, no. Why would they do it? Why would they agree to this? Because one, they were probably going to hand out the money anyway since the other labels had done it. And two, they knew they probably couldn't play the game that I think it was Warner Bros. Did by saying, oh, you owe us money. We're taking it back.
Well, and they don't necessarily have to sell their shares.
No, they don't.
They could just hold on to them. So, in other words, they might agree to something that they never have to fulfill.
I think the idea was that they're probably more likely they were already going to do it anyway, so it wasn't that big of a give.
Correct.
But the big thing is that big deals often set new standards, but Swift's deal insisted on new standards for everyone at the label right out of the bat. I don't think that's ever happened before.
I mean, look, we would have to research that, don't you think? I mean, I would agree with you.
I tried. I couldn't find any example.
Oh, okay. So you already did.
You know, I mean, we know like Jimmy Stewart created a big standard when he went solo from the studios and said, "Okay, I'll take a low fee for these westerns, but I want a gross percentage of the box office." That was, you know, groundbreaking. But it's not like he said, "And I want every other actor in America to get it too." You know, he didn't have that ability to do it. But there are lots of, you know, precedent-setting deals. I can't think of anyone where a person said everybody at the label or everyone at this publishing house or everyone at this studio gets the same, you know, specifics. That's kind of cool. And of course, she's a big selling artist. She still sells a lot of albums in part because she holds them back from streaming. But she is definitely the exception to the rule. Looking at album sales, they are really collapsing. Actual album sales this year are down 25% compared to 1 year earlier. That's why Mumford & Son is able to top the charts and Mariah Carey can get into number 5 with just 40,000 in sales. In US, album sales have been cut in half in the last 3 years. They have collapsed 50% from just 2015, which wasn't that big a year in the first place. So this is really a big problem, and streaming is not making up the difference. Even when you try to convert those streaming figures into equivalent album sales, big albums are not going multi-platinum or even platinum anymore. Certainly not the way they were 10 years ago or the go-go era of the 1980s.
Yeah, and I'm going to paraphrase what I think it was Doug Morris who said, you know, digital dollars, analog dollars for digital dimes. In this case, it's physical dollars for streaming dimes.
Yeah. And this was a shock to me, but in looking at all of this and studying the Billboard Top 200 album chart, I suddenly realized something they've probably been doing for weeks or months. They don't include gold or platinum designations anymore. It used to be when you saw the album charts, you'd see this album had sold 2 million copies, that album had sold 5 million copies, another album had sold 8 million copies, like Carrie Underwood. Multiple, 5 million, 7 million copies.
Yeah, but when you have none, you know, what's the point?
Right. Nobody has going platinum, like one or two albums. And so they've just gotten rid of that for the albums and the singles. They don't even list it anymore. Carrie Underwood, her album hit number one, but after just like 8 weeks on the charts, it's way down at number 90. And if Mariah Carey is selling 40,000 copies, that means Carrie Underwood is selling two. And that doesn't mean her album is a flop as such, though it's not a great sign, but it just means, you know, album sales just aren't what they used to be. And, you know, people are arguably not listening to albums anymore. Anecdotally, young people, by and large, don't and can't even imagine why I insist they should. I'm like, you all should be listening to albums. I'm like, what's an album? I went to see this young act, Alec Benjamin, at the Mercury Lounge. He said, I put out a new mixtape this week. I'm like, it's not a mixtape. It's an album.
People don't even know what tape is anymore. They think it's things to hold pieces of paper to the wall.
I freak out about this because of what it means artistically, but the fact is we're just getting back to the way the things were in the 50s and the 60s. For most of the musical industry era, people put out singles and EPs and an album, then more singles, and the singles weren't on the album. They put those together on another album, and they, you know, then they tour and they put out more music. I mean, that's what the Beatles did. That's what the Stones did. That's what everybody in the 50s did. Elvis, everybody. This is what they did. They just had a constant stream of music. People didn't take 3 years between albums. They never dreamt of such a thing. It was only the 80s, that blockbuster era where albums would spin off, you know, 4, 5, 6 hit singles, and they would tour the world for 3 years. The only problem today is you've got that tug of war. The only place they make money is when they tour, but they need a constant stream of music to keep themselves ever present. And that makes it really hard to do good work when you're always touring, you know, to put out good music.
Well, and Michael, I must say every once in a while, you're right, because you've been complaining that the way they try to create equivalent album sales from streaming is distorting statistics. And Rolling Stone bears that out. I hate the way they do this, by the way. So I've always hated it. You've always hated it. Now you're right. Rolling Stone says so.
Yeah. An analysis by Rolling Stone with a cooperation of a third-party company looked at Drake's album Scorpion, which has 25 tracks. And it has 25 tracks because he wants to game the system. Some people will stream the whole album over and over again. And when you have more tracks, that makes it easier to rack up big numbers. But the truth is, when you look at the actual streaming, almost all of its streaming comes from just three tracks: God's Plan, In My Feelings, and Nice for What. That's over 60% of the entire global streaming from his album. If you look at the six biggest tracks, that's 82% of all its streams come from just six tracks. That means the other 19 tracks accounted for 18% of all the streams. That's less than 1% for each track. That means basically people didn't listen to, you know, 60% of the album. They listened to six tracks and really just three tracks. In other words, Drake had three really big hit singles, but not a big hit album. People were not listening to the album over and over. Same is true for Post Malone. His big album, Beer Bongs and Bentleys, basically three tracks contributed to like over 60% of all the streaming. People are not listening to the albums. They are just playing songs. And if they're listening to God's Plan over and over, awesome. He's got a big hit single, but that should not, you know, translate into a big hit album. If people are just buying the single, it doesn't make a hit album. It makes a hit single. And does it matter? I think it does, because we want an accurate depiction of what's going on. If we want to know exactly how people are consuming music and what they're listening to, Billboard needs to stop fudging the data to make it look like album sales haven't collapsed. They have. Face reality, and then we'll move forward.
Well, I noticed that the UK music industry championed National Album Day, and it got tons of press, and then album sales fell that week.
That's right. They did everything they could, and it's not, the album isn't dead yet, but it's getting there.
Well, speaking of the album being dead, I would say just about everybody in our obituary section is dead, or at least they should be. And we're starting off with William Goldman. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because nobody knows anything.
Right. He died at 87. He's an Oscar winner, great career, almost as famous for saying nobody knows anything in Hollywood as he is for his screenwriting. And everything that he did that was really mattered happened in a wonderful 10 or 12 years, really in just 7 years. He did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in 69. He wrote The Season, a nonfiction book following the Broadway season from 1967 to 68, that theater season from fall to spring. That came out in 69, the same year. Then he wrote The Princess Bride, a classic children's book, a great, great book, really fun. And then he adapted that for the movies later. And then he did All the President's Men in 1976. A great original screenplay, a great adapted screenplay, a great book about the theater, a great children's book. And then as a sort of a cherry on the cake in 1983, he wrote Adventures in the Screen Trade, his book about the movie biz. He also had Misery in 1990, but basically his big era was there, you know, end of the 60s through the mid 70s. He was firing on all cylinders and, you know, a great career.
You know, and he also was a big rewrite guy, and that people would, you know, hire him to come in and do rewrites, most notoriously. And I guess that's a negative word, but most famously, maybe, was Good Will Hunting. And he was quoted in Premiere Magazine about, you know, he didn't get credit, of course, nor did he win the Academy Award the way the, you know, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck did for writing that screenplay, but he helped them toward the end. And he was quoted in Premiere Magazine, actually, during that time period as saying, you know, and this was about Hollywood creative executives, that they were all afraid of being fired, as well they should be, because they will.
Well, yeah, he's a colorful guy. You know, he didn't get credit for Good Will Hunting because they did most of the work. It was ruled that the structure and the characters and the story was mostly, I'm sure he contributed helpfully, but let's not pretend he wrote it and got cheated.
No. I mean, there are Writers Guild rules for that.
Right. So he's gone. And, you know, if you haven't read The Princess Bride, check it out. Roy Clark is gone, a country music legend. He died at 85. Brad Paisley, who I'm a big fan of, and a lot of other country artists were celebrating his artistry, his generous spirit. He's a really nice guy. And yes, of course, Hee-Haw. You know, Hee Haw was one of the most successful syndicated shows in history. It was a huge hit, and not just in rural communities. It was a big hit in urban centers as well. He was also a pioneer of the Bakersfield sound, a rawer, more basic country sound. He did it alongside Buck Owens, who also appeared on Hee Haw. It was sort of a reaction to the country-politan crossover sound of Patsy Cline. It was real country as far as they were concerned. But Hee Haw means why everybody knows Roy Clark and his banjo. At its peak, you know, you talk about how game shows, they can film a lot of their episodes really quickly. At its peak, they would tape all the sketches and all the stuff for an entire year of Hee Haw in just 2 weeks.
Wow.
That's a lot of time in a cornfield.
Well, and I guess you're not being timely. I mean, you're not talking about timely things at that point.
Well, it's just they're sitting in the cornfield going, you hear the one about the used car salesman? You know, and they make us, you know, they stand in the cornfields and tell jokes. You know, and then they're just showing musical acts. But they did really showcase a lot of great country talent. And he also helped popularize Branson, Missouri as a destination site, both for musicians and fans. So, you know, a fascinating, big, long career.
Well, and then you had somebody who I guess was known for working with rock stars, Nicholas Rogue. He's a director. He died at the age of 90. In 1970, he directed Performance, which starred...
He co-directed.
It starred Mick Jagger. Walkabout, great film, by the way. Great film, Walkabout.
That's the one film of his I like, yeah.
You don't like Don't Look Now, 1973?
Not really.
Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie? No?
She's beautiful. It's an interesting movie, but I didn't love it.
The Man Who Fell to Earth, starring David Bowie in 1976?
Yeah, it's a curiosity, but
okay.
It's not a movie that I love, but he had an interesting career. He was a cameraman, a cinematographer, an editor, and you can see people talk about his influence and sort of, you know, jumbling up the time frame of a movie and not being chronological or linear, which certainly he didn't invent, but he helped popularize. He was certainly part of that 70s wave of avant-garde and, you know, individualistic directors. An interesting career, but certainly, you know, he died in 90, had a cool career. People still remember him. So that's pretty good. And we haven't mentioned this guy. I've been wanting to mention him for weeks because I think he's really important for our Asian audience. It's Jin Yong, a.k.a. Louis Cha. He's a beloved Chinese novelist. Think J.R.R. Tolkien in terms of his importance. He's better known by his pen name, Jin Yong, and he died at 94. He penned a dozen martial arts epics like The Legend of the Condor Heroes. He was born in mainland China. He lived in Hong Kong. He was a journalist. He even founded a newspaper. This is cool. He got a degree in Chinese history. History? He got a degree in Chinese history at Cambridge when he was in his 80s. That's pretty amazing. And talk about timing. A British writer named Anna Holmwood translated Volume 1 of The Legend of the Condor Heroes into English for the first time, and it came out in the U.S. on October 18th, just when he died. So that's kind of cool. I've been frustrated for years that I can't read Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the multi-volume series that that movie is based on. I've been dying to do that. It's never been translated into English. He was never translated before, but it's starting to happen. I hope she did a good job, and I'm looking forward to checking it out.
Then over the weekend, Ricky Jay, this guy, I have to say, I really loved this guy. He was quite the sleight of hand magician, and his card tricks were, I saw him perform live at the Geffen Playhouse really close, and you're always looking, how did he do that? He would do these, he'd take people out of the audience, and he'd, do these card tricks right in front of you, and you'd think, how in the world did he get the card from here to there, or the card that the person signed their name to in the wrapped deck that he had them. I mean, it was just absolutely astonishing.
You're talking about Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants, which is probably his most famous theater piece. It was directed by David Mamet, and he was already really well known, but that one just sent him into the stratosphere.
Yes, and now he also was this like historian of magic, and he would spin these yarns as he's doing these tricks about, a famous magician and what that magician's trick was from the 1880s and how that trick worked and how it wowed people and its influence on certain. It was just, he was an actor, a magician, an interesting guy. He died at the age of 72.
And, he was, of course, being a historian, he collected tons of ephemera, of stuff from magic and sideshows and freak shows and all sorts of related material, wrote a couple books about them that were very well received. He's a fascinating person and fascinating collection. And immediately our in-house film critic, Aaron Ritz, said, oh, my God, I wonder what's happening to his collection. I don't know. Maybe he's going to donate it to a university or someone if he thought about this. I don't know. Or if not, we're going to have one of the coolest auctions ever.
That's true, actually. They should he should donate it to a museum and it should just be one wing.
Yeah, exactly. That would be cool. And among his effects, a fax from yours truly.
Really?
Yes. I interviewed him once, maybe just once, and I knew he collected weird ephemera, weird little stories and things, but they had to be documented, and I had at the time was reading physical papers like USA Today, and they have this cool section where they do one story from every state, and they have just weird little digest notes of things, and I was always sort of scanned them to find weird stuff, and it wasn't from the US, but it was from India. There was a story about the Yam Boy. I'm like, well, Yam Boy? I look it up, and the story said, completely straightforward, like from the New Delhi Times or Associated Press in India, something like that. It said a family in a small village in India had accused a neighbor of being a witch and turning their son into a yam. The police have taken the yam into custody and are now doing experiments and collecting evidence. That's all it said. I was like, well, that's weird. And so I had like three of these in it. At the end of the interview, I said, oh, by the way, I got a couple stories for you. And I told him the three stories. And he's like, the Yam Boy, could you fax that article to me? And I said, absolutely. So I got his fax number and sent it over to him. So I like to think somewhere in there is a story about Yam Boy.
when I go to that museum and go to the Ricky Jay wing, I will make sure to look out for that.
That's right. And he died at 72 or maybe 70. Nobody's sure. One last little bit of sleight of hand from Ricky Jay.
Yeah, you got to love it. And he was an actor. I mean, he starred in tons of TV shows.
Deadwood five films from David Mamet. No, he's and Westworld. He was in the first season of Westworld. No, a fascinating guy.
Yeah, that's true. Now, just this morning, Bernardo Bertolucci passed away, Italian director. He died at the age of 77. He's probably best known for Last Tango in Paris.
Last Emperor. Oscar winner. And nine Oscars.
Yeah, and then I was going to say the Last Emperor after that. He may have made his name maybe with The Last Tango in Paris.
Yes.
Okay.
But if it wasn't for The Last Emperor, I don't think most people would have ever heard of him. you know.
Yeah.
They wouldn't know The Conformist or Before the Revolution or certainly 1900. But he's got some very good films. I mean, The Conformist is great. 1900 is interesting. I haven't watched The Last Emperor in years, but I have a feeling it might hold up. And of course, he collaborated a lot with cinematographer Vittorio Storaro. The Conformist is an amazing looking movie. And The Last Emperor looks great, too.
And so does 1900 was very good as well.
I don't know that Storaro worked on that one.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Last Tango in Paris, though?
Yeah, he didn't do that one either.
What?
I don't believe so. I'd have to check.
Okay, well, I'm going to look that one up, too, for Pete's sake. Sheltering Sky, that he did work on.
But that's not a good movie.
Oh, well, okay, fine. I saw and met Bernardo Bertolucci a couple of times. Of course, he was always in Cannes. And more recently, I would have thought he was like 90 years old because he was always in a wheelchair for the past like 8 years every time I saw him. And so I was surprised he was so young, to be honest with you.
And forgive me, Storaro did work on Last Tango in Paris.
That's what I thought. I thought that's where they're kind of... their whole love affair with each other began, no pun intended.
Well, the Conformist. The Conformist was first.
Okay. All right. Good point. My Bernardo Bertolucci story, probably the best one, is I went to a test screening of The Little Buddha, a film that he probably is not known for, that he made in 1993. It stars Keanu Reeves, Chris Isaak, and Bridget Fonda. Not a very good movie. But I'm watching this movie, and behind me for the 2 hours that this movie ran is all I could see was a silhouette of a very fat man, and I could just hear this guy breathing nonstop, and his leg kind of just protruded into the aisle. I was sitting on the aisle, just protruded into the aisle of this screening room, and I was just like, I wanted to turn around and say, look, if you're that sick, can you go something? You know, it didn't sound like he was sick. The lights come up.
It was Bertolucci?
No, it was Harvey Weinstein who was distributing the film.
Oh.
I was like, it's Harvey. Of course. But I love what Maria Schneider said. Maria Schneider was, 19 when she starred in The Last Tango in Paris. And Marlon Brando, who starred opposite her in this romance movie, was like 48. She said, I think Bertolucci is overrated. And he never really made anything after Last Tango in Paris that had the same impact. He
was The Last Emperor might have had a little bit of an impact.
Yeah, well, he was a fat and sweaty and very manipulative. Both Marlon and myself, he manipulated both Marlon and myself and would do certain things to get a reaction from me. Some mornings on the set, he would be very nice and say hello. And on other days, he wouldn't say anything at all. I was too young to know better. Marlon later said that he felt manipulated. And he was Marlon Brando. So can you imagine how I felt?
Yes, well, and her comment about the treatment on set and potential rape was a bit conflated and confused, but still also is part of the reason why Last Tango was controversial then and remains so now.
Yes, but you know what's not controversial?
What?
Our podcast, because you can subscribe to it in any of the podcast aggregators that you are familiar with. The Apple iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us. You can rate and review us. It does help us out when you do. It helps other people find our show as well. So we thank you for doing that in advance. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That's also where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call us and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's William Goldman Dead? Inconceivable.com.
See The Princess Bride for that reference. But in the meantime, if you don't have that on DVD, or you can't find a streaming version of it, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com to read all of his coverage of the entertainment industry, and don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.